You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network. Attention all theater lovers! This Sunday, April 21st, Broadway Podcast Network is holding the first ever Broadway Podfest, a full day of podcast recordings with some of your favorite Broadway stars, live from the Museum of Broadway, which is right in the heart of Times Square. The day begins at 11 a.m. Eastern and features a full day of programming that you don't want to miss. Visit bpn.fm/podfest to get all the details and register to attend for free. That's bpn.fm/podfest.
Hi, and welcome to The Compass, the podcast documenting the struggles of life as an artist. I'm Leah Walsh.
Hi, everyone. My guest today is Giselle O. Alvarez. Giselle is an incredible dancer and performer who also happens to be my sister-in-law. She's had a really interesting path from ballerina to modern dancer to Broadway performer. She just celebrated 5 years as a dancer in Phantom of the Opera. Congratulations. I'm so grateful she was up for being a part of the podcast. It's been a long time coming, and it was a delight to sit down and have this in-depth artistic conversation, something we don't often get to do between family things and our busy lives, and her being an amazing tia to my daughter. I hope you enjoy the 151st episode of The Compass. What do you do to try to keep from going to the dark side as an artist? And then kind of related to that is, what does the dark side look like for you most often when I say that?
I think for me, the dark side definitely looks like depression. Just kind of plainly. Where I... As you know, I'm a pretty extroverted person, mm-hmm. and I love to have a good time, and I usually have a smile on my face. And so the dark side looks like sadness, and there's tears, and it's a visceral feeling. It's something that I feel not just in my mind, but with like my whole body. And you know, as a dancer, I kind of make sense.
Totally.
But sometimes it feels, it's like debilitating because it's so, palpable. So I would say that that's what it looks like for me. It's, I think it's something that people notice immediately because
it's not your normal mode of being.
It's not my normal way of being. So people know when I'm not okay. I'm not very good at hiding it.
Do you feel like it comes up for you just as a chemical, normal cycle in your life? Or do you feel like it's specifically related to your artistic life and career in a different way that can trigger that sometimes? That wasn't very articulate, but...
No, I think it's something that it depends, because sometimes I think it... I'm very fortunate to get to do what I love every day. And there's a lot of then guilt that comes along with being able to sing and dance 8 times a week on a stage, that I feel bad for not wanting to do it, because there's so many people I know who want to be doing what I'm doing and would kill for that opportunity. So then it's like, I kind of cycle in this, like, well, you shouldn't feel bad about, like, you shouldn't ever feel like you don't want to do this because this is all you've ever wanted to do. But then I'm also a human being that has feelings and that, has to, like...
And it's your job.
And it's still a job. At the end of the day, it is 6 days a week, 8 times a week for I'm almost 5 years now that I've been doing this. So... Right. I think the dark side for me is remembering that as much as it is difficult and that it is a job, that, you know, 5 years ago I wasn't doing this. 5 years ago I was waiting tables and I was cleaning dance studios, and the dark side looked very different, you know? So I guess it's just...
Yeah, that's tricky to feel guilty about something you're going through just because you know that it's such a rare situation that you're in.
Yeah, it's unheard of, really. I mean, the show turns 32 today. It's the 32nd anniversary of Phantom of the Opera, and it's mind-boggling that it's just almost as old as I am.
Right.
And that
it's one of the steadiest jobs in theater.
Yeah. And it's hard to, sometimes it's difficult to stay happy when, even though you're getting to do what you've always wanted to do, you know, like anything else, it's still the rigors of doing the same thing over and over again. And so, like, I think for me, I don't know, this is super roundabout. I feel like I'm not quite.
No, we're going to go through all the corners.
We're going to, yeah, we're
going to. All the twisty twirlies. Right?
Like, yeah, because for me, like, what helps me stay in the light is to stimulate myself creatively outside
totally.
Of Phantom. And whatever kind of light that I get from doing the job is just bonus. But I don't rely on the job anymore to give me that full creative juice.
Right.
Because it and it's not that it doesn't, but it has kind of its limit. Like I've reached to the point of like creative fulfillment in that building. And so even though I still get to relive the same scene every night and there's still moments of fun and my cast is incredible and like the audience isn't ever the same. It's never the same show, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And so there's still that, you know, spark of live theater that you never know what really is going to happen. But I found that from personally, if I rely on the show for my creative happiness, it's never going to quite fulfill me.
When in the last 5 years do you feel like you made that realization and started to seek out those other outlets consciously?
I think it kind of hit after the 30th anniversary. I think there was something in my brain that I had set saying, oh, well, I'll only be in the show for about 3 years. Like, I want to hit that 30th mark. You know, 3 years is a kind of substantial amount of time to be with a show, and then, you know, I'll be ready to move on. And so I think something subconsciously kind of like cemented itself that when that time were to come, then it was time for me to move on. And I was fortunate enough to, you know, be at some callbacks for some pretty big shows, but didn't end up booking the show. And so I definitely fell into the dark side.
Yeah.
And
because you had set up this...
this, like, expectation.
Timeline.
This
yourself.
Timeline,
yeah.
Yeah, that is, you know, unrealistic. And, you know, obviously there's so much in our industry that we can't control. And so it really... it kind of manifested in sadness and depression. But then it also... then I got, like, an upper respiratory infection. So, like, I physically got sick. And I was, like, out of the show for a whole week. And then it was one of those moments where I realized that, like, I can't keep spiraling down. Like, it's literally affecting my well-being at this point. So, and for me as a dancer, it's always dance class. Like, if I go to class, I can forget about what's worrying me or what's going on in my brain. And I can just, like, express myself with my body. And just, that's a source of therapy for me that is really difficult to replace. So it's always that go-to, but then that started to feel not enough anymore. And I think as an artist, I've grown so much from being in this show. Like, this is my Broadway debut. It's the first time I've acted on a stage. I use my voice, that I sing. I mean, I even play the cymbals. Like, I do a lot more than has been required of me or expected of me in the past.
In your dance career.
In my dance career. That, you know, as a concert dancer.
Dance, yeah.
Yeah. And so now exploring all these other facets of my creativity, I realize that I don't have the training and the background and the, like, weight of knowledge of how to truly express my creativity in these new facets as I do in dance. And so I realized that just going to dance class wasn't enough, you know, because it doesn't spark that same kind of curiosity of learning a new skill, which is terrifying and, you know, imposter syndrome hardcore.
Right.
But if we're not running towards the fear, then, like, then what are we doing? We're just staying stagnant. And I knew that at that moment I was like, you know what? I didn't book that show because my voice isn't strong enough. I need to commit to vocal lessons. And so for the last year and a half, I've been going to a vocal teacher for, you know, twice a month. Every 2 weeks, I see him religiously, and, you know, my voice has improved. And then I started just building on that, where it's like, okay, great. I have this. This is now kind of a steady thing. Like, what else can I learn? And I think that's part of it too, is being in the same show, doing the same thing 8 times a week. It's not stimulating anymore, despite its like production value. And then it's like, it's, you know, it's a huge show with all of these set pieces and ridiculous melodrama. Like, it is big and entertaining, but somehow being on the other side of it, it doesn't kind of fulfill that. I don't know, the wide possibility of like creative stimulus. And mm-hmm. So I think, I don't know, like being a student again and learning something new, I think that that's what I feel like I was missing. And still to this day, I'm constantly seeking opportunities to be a part of a process, be a part of creating something new or learning something new, where I find that that's what keeps me excited and feel alive and feel present in January of 2020. Because that's the other thing. Like, this show was made in 88.
Right.
You know, like, this is a very, we joke that it's like the majestic time warp, because like we have no concept of time in that building. And it's insane to me that I've been there for half a decade. Like, that is still really hard to wrap my head around.
Of course. But also in
5 years, like that's still a significant amount of time, but it also feels like I debuted a month ago.
I completely understand. Yeah, but it is, like, for what you were talking about, like, it's also in a beautiful way drawing on that tradition of storytelling. It's not drawing on like today's version of like what a play could be, or like what the different mode of storytelling that you could use, or how dance could be used in that production.
Totally. Yeah. I mean, the dancing is just a, like, a byproduct, I feel, of the storytelling. It's because, because it's set in an opera house with an opera company that has dancers, but it's not about dance.
Right.
So I think that's another way where I have learned that, or I guess more why I felt so unqualified for the job at times, because yes, I have a certain set of skills that make me appropriate for this job. But when you start looking at what the show is about and what the story is and telling that story, it's not about the tendu or the rendezvous or like what my ballet technique is. It's just, it's about telling the story. And so I realize almost the moments in which I'm not dancing, when I'm just background of color, of setting a scene, like that's where the storytelling is. And that's how the audience is going to understand like who I am in this big world of people who is not the important person. It's right. Not like the main story, but how I'm adding and it's to tell that story.
Yeah.
And then it's like, that's what keeps me still putting a smile on my face and still going to work and still really enjoying it, is because then that's where I get to be creative. It's not in the things that I'm really skilled at. It's in the doing the things that I'm not skilled at. Right. That makes sense.
Yeah. I love that though, because we just recorded the episode that'll be right before you with our friend Monic yesterday, and he was saying how much he's like, this is something that we talk about a lot on the podcast, but how the things that you do outside of the job that someone gave you are really the things that are going to carry you through in the long term. Mm-hmm. And he was like, it's even more important for you to do those things when you have a job, mm-hmm. because then you have paid time to pursue them.
Right.
Like, even if you're super busy doing the job you're getting paid for, any time when you're on a break or when you have the morning or whatever, you're like, you're not worrying about where the paycheck's going to come from, mm-hmm. and you can focus on learning those new skills. And I was like, that just makes so much sense. Well, yeah. Sometimes it's hard to utilize those times because, honestly, and I'm sure from this long-term show you can speak to this, you need to do self-care. You need to sleep. You need to wash your dishes. You need to do your laundry. It takes some discipline to utilize that time the way you're doing, to take classes, to further your skills, you know, not just maintain your body.
Right.
Which is important.
Which is, it's still a part of it too, yeah. Because then, you know, it's like you have, with a show like this, there's repetitive stress. And so I have two workman comps claim out for the right side of my body, my hip and my ankle, that I've extended now because it's not that I'm off. I'm not injured enough to not do the show, but I'm not getting better in a normal amount of time because I'm still doing the show. I'm still repetitively stressing the same areas of my body. So that's PT twice a week. And then, you know, then there's...
And this is all outside of your work hours.
Exactly. Yeah. That's seeing a physical therapist, you know, twice a week. And then on top of that is like, to keep my body in check, I can't just do the show because it's totally lopsided. So I have to go to ballet class at least once a week. And everybody is different. Every body is different. But personally, like if I don't take a ballet class a week, a yoga class, and then something for fun, whether it's hip hop or theater or modern, contemporary, like moving my body in another way, because I am more than just a ballerina. I like to move my body in many different kinds of ways. And so for me, like that feeds my soul and that keeps me, keeps my body in check too, because I'm keeping all of those skills still sharp. Because I don't want to lose all of, you know, the decades of work that I've put in to cultivate this body to do what it can do. And so, you know, for a career that hopefully will extend beyond Phantom of the Opera one day, you have to, it's so much about what you do outside of the show, because the show itself doesn't keep you in check. Does that make sense? Like, yeah. And it's not even just that. Then there's like, now I see a vocal therapist because I had pharyngitis last year and it just wasn't getting better. And I was concerned that it was something way worse. And so hopefully I've been really good about not speaking in my vocal fry, but like my speaking voice, like the way that I use my voice generally is not healthy. And so learning how and when to use my voice, all the different ranges that it can hit, mm-hmm. like not just sitting in this place.
Right, right.
So learning about, you know, these tiny little muscles that, I mean, I have so much control of my body, but these little guys are so new and foreign to me. And
there's just always more to learn.
Yes. And so then so now I see a vocal therapist as well. And like, you know, like I don't have, you know, I'm pretty open about who I am. And, you know, I also am living with multiple sclerosis. So that includes mm-hmm. doctor's visits. That includes infusions every 28 days. That includes seeing a mental therapist twice a week, uh-huh. which I still see, who is such a source of stability and help for those dark moments. Because having somebody to just bring things to speech to helps kind of understand what's going on.
Yeah.
In your head, so that you're not like, I don't know, it like holds me accountable. So yeah, and so then it's like, it's just nonstop. It's just you're always there's always something else that you can be doing. And I'm trying to get better. Goals for 2020 is, you know, slow down, like
take some downtime.
Yeah, take some like rest, like sleep. Take a whole day off. Like if you're not well, call out. It's okay. That's what they're there for. Mm-hmm. That's why there are sick days.
I feel like must be a whole different thing in a long running show. Cause that, you know, if you're doing in a show that's only has a month of performances, there's kind of this frantic, the yes. show must go on quality.
Yes.
Whereas in a show like yours, there are protections built in mm-hmm. to give you vacation days off if you really need them.
Yeah. And there, I mean, especially something that is so physical, you know, like it's, I mean, my responsibility in the show is not as intense as some of the principles, but like the emotional turmoil that you go, that an artist puts themselves through, like sometimes you just can't do it because like you can't get there. And so you're not going to put out your best performance because emotionally what you have to do is so intense and visceral that I couldn't imagine not having those days put in. It's a lot what we do because we express so much emotion that I think it sometimes you don't realize how it actually takes a physical toll in your body until you stop doing it. Or
how you're carrying it into the rest of your life.
Yeah.
Yeah. When you were first joining the show and kind of learning the rules of equity and how this new musical theater world worked, did you feel like people were straightforward with how all of those protections worked? Or did you at first feel like, I can't ask for the day off. I can't take care of myself yet because I'm proving myself or something, you know?
I think it was made very clear about how sick days work, how personal days work, that those things were available to me.
We put so much pressure on ourselves.
Oh, yeah. And it's definitely a dancer mentality too, for sure, where it's like, oh, well, I twisted my ankle. It's fine. Like, it's fine. I can just, you know, wrap it up and keep going or take a bunch of Advil and just, you know, push through and power through. But one of the most integral pieces of advice that I was given was from Lynn Ablis, who I don't know if you know.
I know.
But you know her brother.
Her brother, yeah.
So she was in the show for a long time. And this advice was given to her by someone who was in the show for a long time. Her name was Chris Koop, and she has since passed. But her words still ring true in my ears that it's a marathon, not a sprint. And so that, keeping that in mind, that because of our unique situation, you have to prep for a marathon. It's not, you don't know when the end date is. And we're very lucky to not have a closing date, but there's no closing date. Like,
so you
this is the
yourself.
Show that never ends. Like, it keeps going, which is so amazing and so, you know, unique. But that at the same time, it's like you're also a human being who's not going to be at 100% all the time. And you have to, if you're going to be in it for the long haul, then you have to prep your body and your mind for that. And so just remembering that it's a marathon.
Yeah.
You know, I think that's the thing that kind of always kind of rang true for me. And so then we get 1 week of paid vacation every 6 months that is accrued kind of like per week that you work. So it's either the time or the money. Like, it's not really equivalent. You can take the time or the money differently, but essentially after 6 months, you've earned a week of your salary that you can take a vacation. And the idea of a paid vacation just sounds incredible. Right? So I mean, I think to the day, like I debuted on February 6th, and I think on August 6th, I took my week vacation. And I have found that if I don't take a week off every 6 months, I go crazy. Where it's not just for my body, which of course it needs, because we don't ever get more than one day off.
Right.
But it's for my brain, for my heart, for my soul, to like not be in that building, not like to appreciate all the things that it can give me. But sometimes if you work yourself too hard and you don't give yourself the appropriate time to like rest and recover, you're not going to finish the marathon,
right?
Let alone, you know, keep running it. So yeah, I think for me, it was something that I've been really good about making sure that I take vacation. And the sick days like that, I'm still learning. But I'm getting better at it. I'm getting better at it. Where it's like, yeah, well, and you know, it's a process. Like, everything's a process, yeah. Right? But, you know, I think, oh, well, I'd rather just call out on a one show day so that I have the whole day to rest. But then, you know, I went in for a matinee on a Saturday and I was kind of feeling like shit. And, you know, I thought, well, I'm already here. I can just do it. And then I was like, or I can just call out of the evening show and go home and sleep.
Right.
And that's what I did. Like, I went to bed at 8 and I didn't wake up until like 10 the next morning. Oh, and I was like, God. I guess, yeah, my body needed that. Like, sometimes I think, well, I'm already there, I'll just power through. But if I'm not even at 80%, that's not for the greater good,
right?
You know, and that's not good for the audience either. And that's why we have swings. And that's why there are people who are there on the bench We're ready to step in if you're not feeling your best.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I think, I mean, it's like a greater conversation as to why it's hard for me to call out, because, you know, I think it's like MS-wise, I'm like, no, but I got to do it now because I can. And so, like, there are, like, right. emotional issues that
There's a lot of layers.
There are a lot of layers. Yeah, lots of layers. Lots
we
of layers.
We don't have to talk about this if you don't want to, mm-hmm. but I was going to ask you about your MS.
Yeah.
And how you've been feeling these days, and how, if you've met any other artists who are dealing with this particular disease, if you've, how it's been affecting you recently with how you think about your career and your creativity.
Yeah,
that's
I think
a lot
it,
of questions.
Yeah, no, they're great questions.
Anything you want to tell me on this subject, I would love.
I love these questions. So I have recently been so much more empowered by my disease.
Because you got diagnosed, has it been 3 years?
Yes.
3 years ago you found out.
Yes, it was April of 2016. Right. Yeah, so almost four years. And I was very fortunate to have been at the show with the fantastic Equity Insurance that allows me to see, I think, the best doctors in the city and get the best medication. And it was caught early. And so I think being so fortunate to have been diagnosed and to be on a medication that is preventing it from progressing gives me a lot of hope mm-hmm. for the future. Now, granted, that doesn't mean that I don't have anxiety about what could be, and hence the therapy twice a week.
Right.
But it's something that I think has kind of empowered me to not wait, because I can't guarantee, I mean, nobody can guarantee, I can get hit by a bus tomorrow. Like, MS might not be the reason why I die, but I can do things now, so why don't I? So I think when it comes to my creativity and to get to learning more things and more skills, it's like, what am I waiting for? And I think back to that first year on Broadway, which was wonderful. And I relished in not having to take auditions and, you know, just kind of like do the job. But then I think, like, why wasn't I taking vocal lessons then? Like, why wasn't I taking acting classes? Like, I have all this time. Why wasn't I using the time that I had to be pursuing this fully? Like, what am I waiting for? What do I stall for? You know? So I think being diagnosed then kind of gave me that push that I needed to not be afraid of doing new things and just trying them. Like, you know, nobody is an expert at everything.
Right. People, well, you have to lose.
Yeah.
That's one of the things. I feel like there's a really famous Ira Glass quote about this, but of being okay with being bad at something at first. Mm-hmm. Because of course you're going to be bad at it at first, but we are so focused on being perfect, or just, we think as adults that we should already be proficient in something, even though we haven't tried it.
Right.
That we skip that step of, like, it's okay to be bad.
Yeah.
You're learning.
And I think that's part of it too, where as adults, we get good at things. And so we know how good it feels to be good at things.
Right.
And so, you know, nobody wants to be bad at something. Like, it doesn't feel good to be bad at something, but the only way to get better is to keep doing it. And that's how we got good at the things that we're good at. So I think that's that. And what keeps us, I feel, from doing that is just all the, like, inhibitions that we, and the walls that we put up as adults when we were children. Like, we didn't care. We were just like, okay, whatever, no big deal. And, like, that is the, like, I try and go back to that girl. Like, remember when you were fearless and you didn't care what people thought and you just tried something because you wanted to without caring about whether the outcome was perfect? You know, just try. So like, I think my disease has given me the kind of like the push to be a little bit more fearless. And I think, I mean, I don't know, like, quoting all the musicals, but like, No Day But Today, you know, like, I've always loved that song and I've always loved that message in Rent. And I think it never really rang more true than after I was diagnosed, because it's like, what am I waiting for?
Yeah.
You know, I think, I mean, I went to Europe last year and I think there was a part of me that was waiting to meet the man of my dreams so he would take me to Paris. Right, and it's right, like, right. Notre Dame is on fire and I've never seen it. Yeah. What am I waiting for? Yeah. I'm going to go see it. And even though I couldn't really see it because it, you know, it's not open, but like I was there and I ate that really awesome gelato and like, you know, like I want to see and do everything.
Yeah.
Because I can. And I feel like it's a disservice to people who can't by not living the life I can live, you know?
Yeah.
So I think that's how kind of I approach my disease. And so then sometimes it can get the better of me where I'm just like, go, 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 go. And then I'm like, okay, but you also have a degenerative disease, Giselle.
You should sleep.
Yeah, you should just rest or, you know, right. Like...
It's a fine line.
Yeah. And a lot of times too, emotionally as well, I don't know if my mood swings are MS related or lady related, you know, mm-hmm. like I question a lot of times if my symptoms are because I'm just a human being or is it because of my disease?
Right.
'Cause mood swings are something that affects a lot of patients with MS. And so is depression, you know, but also depression runs in my family. And so right. like, those are things where I try and understand where it's coming from. And then I realize that it doesn't really matter.
You just have to deal with
it. You just have to deal with it. Like you just have to figure out how to.
Have you found it useful to like meet other people your age who are dealing with the same disease or has that not really been as much a part of your process?
Sadly, there is a support group for people my age, but it's at night. On a Tuesday. So I've been to one meeting before, but there wasn't really many people who were my age. They were a little bit older. And the thing with MS too is that it affects everybody differently. Like for me, it attacked my optic nerve. So I, you know, experienced issues with my vision. But for other people, it attacks their muscles or their joints. Or for other people, it attacks their bowel movements. And so like it's really kind of the reason why it's not cured is because we don't know why it chooses to attack what part of the central nervous system. But what we can do is prevent it from progressing, which is amazing. And so that has been difficult for me, but I recently went to a, what was it? It was the Walk MS, appreciation dinner or whatever. They had like a certificate award ceremony where they gave us a certificate for raising money for Walk MS. And there I met two wonderful human beings who I just like instantly connected with, mostly because it was open bar and we were the last ones surrounding the open bar. We were like, why did everybody leave? And like, oh, you're awesome. You're cool. And then we went out afterwards and got food because of course we were starving. And we just started chatting about stuff. And Sammy doesn't have MS, but she, her mom does. And so that's why she's really passionate about the cause. And then Jack has a lot of friends and family who have MS, but he personally doesn't have MS. And so like the three of us have kind of created this little support group of our own where we have a group chat and, you know, we kind of text each other. And actually I've joined my team with Jack's team.
Oh, that's great.
So
for this year.
Yeah, for this year. Yeah, for this year coming up. And so it's interesting because I feel like I'm more connected to it's not necessarily just people who have MS, but people who care about the cause.
Yeah.
And I'm on the committee for Walk MS this year.
Oh, cool.
Where I mean I kind of just like sit there and listen because it's my first year, so I don't know. But I think I want to be more involved, and I want to use my story and whatever public platform that I have to raise awareness of like, this is what MS looks like. And, you know, I've slowly but surely I'm trying to figure out how I can be helpful to not just the cause, but to other people who have the disease to, you know, be like, look, you can be on Broadway too. You can do 8 shows a week if you want to, you know, and like, this is what MS looks like. You know, it's not just because I'm not in a wheelchair doesn't mean I don't have this disease. And
right.
and it's affecting over a million people in the United States, which is a lot of people. And so I think in that way, we're trying to find a community of others who also care about what I'm going through. Even if they're not going through it, I get support from them.
Yeah.
And so that's something that I've been trying to also like kind of cultivate, because I think it's important for me personally, for my own, you know, emotional well-being, to be surrounded by people who are like me, yeah. who also have this disease.
No, because obviously your friends and family care about you so much and are supporting you, but it's good to have people who you aren't in those intimate relationships with who understand in a different way.
Yeah.
And who aren't worried about you in that, you know what I mean? Like
yeah.
that close family. They don't have their attachment to mm-hmm. their worry and sadness about something or concern in the same way, but they have that understanding and mm-hmm. that shared ground.
Yeah. I mean, I don't feel like I have like
sadness wasn't the right word. That's not what I meant.
No, but I get that. I mean,
concern.
Yeah. Concern is definitely palpable with my family. Our family.
Of course. Parents.
Yeah.
Obviously
like,
you're
yeah, like
your kid,
like
they want to make sure you're okay.
Of course. So yeah, that like I understood what you meant by sadness, because I
yeah,
like I see it, but I see it in them and that they worry about me all the time. And it's like, but I'm great. Like I'm actually amazing. Like
right.
like this is I'm good. And if I'm not good, I will let you know, I promise. Right. You know? Yeah.
Anyway.
I had to think about that. I'm like, would I let them know? Yes, probably
yes,
I will.
Yes,
of course I will. Of course I will. Because, you know, I'm also just trying to be better about being vulnerable and being honest. And,
yeah, no,
you know,
and
like,
I'm so glad that you're
not always
involved.
Sharing the happiness, but sharing yeah. the sadness too.
Right.
Praised by Lin-Manuel Miranda as the future of musical theater, SUFS creator Shayna Taub makes Broadway history as only the second woman to write the book, music, lyrics, and star in her own original new musical. Don't miss the much-anticipated Broadway debut of the singular artist that Forbes calls visionary and Billboard anoints as one of the most inventive voices in musical theater. SUFS, the original new musical from Shayna Taub, is now playing on Broadway at the Music Box Theater. Get your tickets today at SUFSmusical.com.
Can we switch gears and talk yeah. a little bit about your dance career before Phantom, before
sure.
you came to New York?
Yeah.
Because you were dancing in D.C. for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
From Miami, going way back.
Oh, yeah. 305, honey.
I'm sure I mentioned this in the intro, but Giselle's my sister-in-law.
Yeah.
Grew up in Miami. And then you decided to go right into professional dance. You didn't go to college after high school, right?
Correct.
And
correct.
So you've been dancing professionally since you were, what, 17 or 18?
I was fortunate enough to train at Miami City Ballet School, and I started dancing with the company when I was 15. So yeah, I've been dancing.
You were already working professionally.
Yeah, I mean, I was a student dancing with the company, so I wasn't getting paid
right.
to perform with them, but I was given point shoes, which was pretty much like payment because shoes are expensive. And you know, if we would travel to, because at Miami City they have 4 home theaters. So it's not just in Miami proper, but then in Broward and West Palm Beach and in Naples to do like the Nutcracker or any of their programs that they do all season. So when we would travel to the theaters that weren't in Miami, we'd get a per diem, which again, I would just like, you know, hoard hospitality at the theater and, you know, use that as money to, you know,
Be a teenager,
yeah, which I spent most of my time dancing. But yeah, so I gained a lot of professional experience when I was still in high school. And then, yeah, the plan was to stay in Miami because I didn't get a job at Miami City Ballet as a like an apprentice. At the time, they were just starting a second company, but I had a friend who auditioned for the Carolina Ballet, and she came back saying, like, he's still hiring. Like, you should go to North Carolina and audition for him. So I went because my uncle lives there. So I had somebody to stay with. And, yeah, ended up getting an apprenticeship at 18 with the Carolina Ballet. And so, yeah, I ended up moving in August after my senior year of high school to North Carolina and lived with my friend who had also gotten a job as well and started my first job right out of high school, which is crazy. And then I got to a point where I was budgeting and I wasn't making enough money as an apprentice to, like, I was just enough to, like, pay my rent.
Right.
But then, like, if I wanted to go to the movies, I didn't have any money for that. So then I started working at Starbucks. So I would work at Starbucks in the morning and then go and dance all day or reverse dance all day and then work closing shifts. Yeah, and it started my career as not just a dancer, but as, like, a person.
Yeah, no, I was going to say,
all of the jobs I had.
I mean, you've worked in retail as well, but you've mm-hmm. you had a very, when you were living in D.C., and when you first moved to New York, mm-hmm. like, you had a long kind of side career in the restaurant business.
Oh, yeah, definitely. I think it certainly has always been something that I have valued because, I don't know, I'm not your, like, typical ballerina. Like, I have interests that exceed beyond just the world of ballet. And so I felt like it always gave me this balance of, like, talking to people who didn't know what theme and variations is or, you know, don't know every step to Stars and Stripes. Like, you know, it felt like it made me feel normal, if you will. Like, and so, I think I've always kind of gravitated towards doing things that weren't necessarily in the arts. My first restaurant job was in North Carolina after Starbucks, which I guess is technically still, yeah. Like, there's still, like, serving involved, you know, like, being nice to other people.
Definitely coffee hospitality. Shop and restaurant.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah, yeah. Different vibe, but yeah. Certainly in the hospitality industry. And, I feel like it was just a restaurant that a lot of the dancers used to go to. And so then we were, like, in the kind of, like, apartment, like, house complex that we lived at, we had a friend, Jason, who worked at Shabashabu. And so then I ended up getting a job there because I'd make more money as a hostess mm-hmm. than I would at Starbucks. And so then that's kind of where I learned, where began kind of my restaurant life and learned from, like, the ground up, like,
right.
how to be a host and then seeing how kitchens run and then eventually serving and then bartending and
right.
things like that.
How did you, like, when you were working with dance companies in DC and when you first moved to New York, how did you feel like that balanced with your auditioning and with your performing schedule?
So in DC, it was a little
If you were to do
different.
It again, would you go back to that industry or would you try to find something else? If you were in that position where you needed the side job again?
I would probably go back.
Yeah.
Because I personally found a lot of joy in serving people, food and wine. I have a passion personally for it. And so I think that that's kind of what radiates when I would do the job. And often people would be like, wow, you seem so happy. And I'm like, well, you know, like, I'm not taking out the trash for a living. You know, right. I'm always looking at the cup half full.
Somewhat enjoyable,
you know,
to me.
And yeah. And at the end of the day, as long as it was something that I believed in, I felt like
right.
I could sell it. Because I wasn't trying to sell you on something
like
that wasn't.
Food.
Yeah.
Right.
You know, like, Boqueria was such a staple for me, but it took me 6 months to become a senior server that I pretty much had all of the shitty shifts, which means I had to work during the lunch shifts, which means I couldn't go to auditions. But I had to put in my time so then I could get the better shifts, that I would make the more money, so I would have to work as much, so I could have my
the
mornings
free.
So then I could go to auditions.
Right.
And I think it's possible, but if you don't like it, then you should find something else that you do like. And for me, because I believed in what we were doing, what the food we were selling, that it wasn't hard for me. Cause I was just like, we're not going to war here. We're just having lunch. What do you like? Are you a vegetarian? Do you like fish? Do you like meat? Look, this is really good. This is also delicious. What do you like? I'm sure we have something that you'll enjoy. You know, like it, to me, it didn't seem like that difficult because I wasn't like trying to con somebody into spending a lot of money. Like, like that's not why I was there. And personally, as someone who enjoys going out to dinner and eating food and drinking wine, like I want to share that love. And so I think for me, it's certainly an industry that is my plan B, if you will, you know, if I had to go back, but I don't think I would dislike it.
Right.
You know what I mean? I think I'd still find joy in it.
When you were working in, would you call it concert dance or modern dance? Like when you were in DC?
Yeah, I'd say concert dance.
Concert dance. Mm-hmm. When you were working in concert dance, were there any big lessons that you feel like you learned as an artist in that particular version of the art form?
I found so much liberation in concert dance. Particularly the difference between the ballet world and the contemporary modern. You know, they're technically both concert dance, right? But there is this stigma about body type and image in ballet. And it's always been something that has followed me where, you know, I've been told by directors that I'm very talented and I can dance circles around soloists, but my thighs are too big to be put in pink tights on stage. So you're not going to get a full-time job here, or we're not going to rehire you. And those things have shaped me to have the thick skin that I have and have taught me that that is a subjective opinion. Thank you so much for your time. That doesn't mean that I can't dance, you know? And so when I went from ballet to modern, all of a sudden I wasn't, nobody gave a shit about what I look like.
Like, look what those powerful thighs can do.
Exactly.
Lifting that other person.
Yeah. Or how about, it's not about what your body looks like. It's the art that you're doing. It's what you're doing that matters. It's not about what this idea of perfection and like what's supposed to, like there is no supposed to.
How did you make that transition? Were you always kind of, I am going to be a ballerina? Or were you, when that opportunity presented itself, you were open to it?
So what happened was, I wasn't told whether or not I was going to get a job at the Washington Ballet full time. And so I started auditioning. And I auditioned for Ballet Memphis and for City Dance Ensemble within the same week. And City Dance Ensemble is a company in DC that's a contemporary based, and obviously Ballet Memphis is Ballet Memphis. And on the same day, I was offered a job from both places. I know. I went from zero job to two jobs in one day, right?
I want to have that. I want to have that day.
It was mind-boggling, right? And the only reason why I auditioned for City Dance was because I sent my headshot and resume to every dance company in the DC metro area.
Right.
Like African, Indian, like styles that I'm not skilled at, but I was like, well, I live in DC and like...
I'm a dancer.
So let's just send it all out there. And they got back to me and I auditioned for them. And like I said, they offered me a company position because they don't have like... Everyone's just an ensemble member. And then I was offered an apprenticeship with Ballet Memphis. And, you know, at the time I was dating somebody. So like the lure of staying in DC was, you know, a little bit because of that person. But then also there were more weeks of work in DC than there were in Memphis. The pay was better. And, you know, Ballet Memphis was going on tour that year, but to like Atlanta, Georgia. And City Dance Ensemble was going to go to tour in Jordan, like the Middle East.
Right.
And I've never left the country at that point. I didn't even have a passport.
How exciting.
And so it just seemed like an opportunity that I couldn't say no to. And even though it was terrifying and you know, lots of imposter syndrome of like, can I even do this? Like I'm a ballet dancer. But, you know, I just kind of like went for it because they wouldn't have offered me a job if they didn't think I could do it. And so they believe in me. And so I was like, all right, well, I'm going to believe in myself. And then finding that liberation of being able to take class every day and not like look in the mirror and judge every, you know, role or crevice of my body and just kind of embrace who I was as a person could then just let me be myself as an artist in a way that, like, I don't think I ever really experienced prior to that.
What a relief.
It was.
You didn't even know you needed, probably.
Yeah. Fully. I had no idea. And it's funny because my friend Jade at the time, she came and, like, took class at City Dance. Or she came and saw a show or something, and she told me, she was like, Giselle, I've never seen you dance like that before. Like, you're just radiating. You look so happy. You know, and it's just like taking ballet class. Like, it wasn't even like, it wasn't like I was performing or it was a show of some sort, but like she could see the difference in just like my soul, where I could just be myself. And it was
that makes me
really
so happy
incredible.
Just to hear you retell that story.
Yeah. It was really, really, really amazing. Uh-huh. And so, I don't know, I always try and draw back to those experiences and remember, like, you know, I've certainly had moments since then where I'm being judged by my body or I've been told I need to lose weight or, you know, but then I remember, like, you can't diminish my light. You can't diminish the passion that I have for this because it's more important. It's more important. And that's why I'm an artist. That's why I do this, because I can't not do this.
Well, we could talk forever.
I know.
I'm going
God,
to like slowly try to wind it up.
Okay.
I know I'm not ready to, but it's been a long time. Is there a lesson that you're really proud of that you've learned in the last year or two that you want to share? Something small or large?
Well, I don't know if it's like a lesson or if it's just it's like an affirmation, you know, like never underestimate your potential. Because, I don't know, I think maybe it's the way I was raised. Maybe it's, like, the dancer in me that's always, like, striving for perfection. But it's not, like, there's always more. And it's not in, like, I don't know, it's not, like, in a consumption kind of way where, like, we need a lot of things. But it's more, like, I don't know. I don't ever want to feel like I'm satisfied or it's just like this is it, like being stagnant. I think that's one of the things I fear the most, of just being like complacent and satisfied,
not striving for more.
Yeah. And so I think that there's always something new to learn. There's always a new way to challenge yourself. And I think that that's what's exciting about life, is that you get to do those things. So, I don't know. I don't want to miss out.
Two little questions I always ask at the end.
Okay.
And then we'll wrap it up. When you do feel yourself going to that dark place, or you're kind of having a lull, mm-hmm. are there any concrete things that you reach for again and again, like books you go back to or music you listen to or places you go that can help you get out of it?
This is funny because I actually do this because of the podcast, because of something I heard at the podcast by a good friend of ours, Alejandro Rodriguez.
Episode one,
I find water. I think that's one of the reasons I love my apartment, is because I can see the river, and maybe because we're Miami kids and like the ocean is something that is so like embedded in our lives. But I find my way towards the river even if it's smelly.
It really does have an impact.
I think something about it is just like really calming, and the fact that it's infinite as well, you know? So that's something that I definitely go to, food. Like,
okay.
there is nothing like something
the most basic
delicious.
And the most important.
Yeah, but like there's nothing like something delicious to make me feel better.
Yeah.
You know, and I do kind of have a, you know, pretentious taste in food, in the sense where like I will spend all my money on something delicious, because to me that's worth it. And so, you know, like sometimes it's a chocolate chip cookie from Culture, and that's gonna make me feel better, or it's French fries from Five Guys, you know, like there are certain things that I know will make me happy. And so I think that indulging in those tiny things help.
It's funny because I took
Ceci a couple weeks ago to Gantry State Park in Long Island City, mm-hmm. and we were walking right by the fence on one of the platforms along the water, and I saw her just looking at it for the first time, and I was like, I don't know if she's ever really noticed when we've been by the river before, mm-hmm. and I was thinking about that. I was just like, this is gonna be a relationship that she feels for her whole life, because mm-hmm. I feel that same way about water, and I was like, I'm seeing this happen right now.
That's amazing.
And then the final question is, have you seen anything recently of any art form that you want to recommend, or consumed anything of any art form? I know you, since you're in a show, it's hard to see other shows, but
yes,
I feel like you do so many shows.
Yeah, I really do, actually.
But it could be also a book, a movie, whatever.
I like to say like too many shows, not enough days off. Mm-hmm. I'm still obsessed with Parasite. That's probably one of the most.
I think about it all the time.
It's still so visceral, that movie going experience. I mean, and it's since closed, so that's annoying. But Slave Play was probably one of the more moving experiences I've had in a theater lately. You know what, though? Also closed, though. I'm the worst recommending things that aren't open anymore. But The Wronged Man. I went and saw it at MCC, and it was...
I heard that that was very good.
It was so, so great. And it's... Travis Wall choreographed it, and talking about how dance is a vessel for storytelling. It's definitely the kind of work that I'm interested in doing and being a part of. And so, getting to witness that, sit in an audience and watch it and have it affect me. It was just really fun. It was a really, really fun ride. I hope it has another life. I'll be in for it.
Well, this was a long time coming, but I really appreciate you coming on the podcast.
Yeah, I really appreciate you having me.
Yay. Thank you for listening to the Compass Podcast. If you find these conversations valuable to your life as an artist and would like to support the ongoing production of The Compass, please consider becoming a patron at patreon.com/thecompasspodcast. Pledges start at as little as $1 a month. Anything you can give would be greatly appreciated. Also, if you have a moment, please rate or review in iTunes. Every little bit helps other listeners to find the podcast. I'd like to thank the following people for their generosity. The Compass cover art is by Kim Miller. Music by Brandon Spieth, audio assistance from Nick Choksi, and a special thanks to Frankie J. Alvarez. See you next time.
They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway, and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com. If you love Broadway gossip, you are not going to want to miss any episode of this podcast, Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway. Plenty of dramas unfold on stage, but the best dramas unfold backstage. And there were no bigger dramas than behind the scenes of Sunset Boulevard.
So you were being crucified over here, but yeah. Not there.
No. No, because I was turning in a performance that would get standing ovations. Excuse me.
So check out my podcast, Singular Sensation, for all the juicy and gory details of Sunset Boulevard.